could detect here.
Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We are very lucky today to have a special presentation and some special guests who have come all the way from Utah. We really appreciate that and the opportunity to work out their schedule to speak with us today in our committee about their management of school trust lands, which should be a really helpful and interesting discussion, something that we've spent a lot of time considering in the last year or two. So why don't I welcome Senator Wieger, who's going to introduce our two guests.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members. It's an honor to have our guests from Utah to talk about school trust lands. As you know, we've discussed a number of proposals during the past few years to look at how we can get a better handle on the constitutional intent in Minnesota for funds to go to school districts and that whole process of the management of these lands to get that constitutional intent. So we've expanded our permanent school advisory committee, which you're a member, Senator Saxhaug, others. We've added private sector members. And we've also looked at what other states are doing. And Utah is a great example where back in the 70s and the 80s and then finally in 1994, they implemented a model which I think would make a lot of sense here in Minnesota. To address this, we have Margaret Bird and Kevin Carter. Margaret is the director of the Utah Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools, called CLASS. She has worked in this field for more than three decades and has a great track record, many awards, and did her undergrad work in mathematics and then economics, as well as work on a PhD. She works for the Department of Education, and she's known as being tenacious, and I guess her nickname is the Junkyard Dog. So,
whoa.
And, but she's tenacious for the schools just and this cause. And so we'll hear from Margaret very soon. And we also have Kevin Carter. Kevin is the director, the state director of the Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration, the state agency that provides an overview of the trust money and, again, looking at maximizing the return to the schools. And they're going to tell you how they do that, this board that's appointed by the governor and various programs that they have. And with no further ado, I will turn this over to Margaret Bird for a presentation, who will be followed by Kevin Carter.
Thank you very much, Senator Wieger. And let me just say also by way of introduction that the bill, there has been a bill introduced in the Minnesota legislature that I believe is modeled after the Utah program. Is that correct? So this will be very, very instructional for us. And again, we want to welcome you all the way from Utah. And luckily, we have a little bit of spring-like weather to enjoy, even though it's gray. I have to apologize. I'm going to sit over there and eat my lunch so that my brain will function better and I will not be crabby while Vice Chair Saxhaug chairs for the next few minutes. I just want to apologize. I have to step away, but I'll be listening carefully. So with that, we'll turn it over to Senator Saxhaug.
Welcome. Who's going to start this discussion? Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you.
We are recording this, are we not? Okay, so for the record, would you identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm Margaret Bird. I work for the State Board of Education in Utah, as well as several other beneficiaries, and I'm also the director of the Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools, that is an organization of 22 states, of which Minnesota is one of those states. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to be here today and talk to you about an issue that we both feel very passionately about. And it's because the changes that we've made in Utah are making a real difference in the life of every school child in our state. That was not the case 15 years ago. I'd like to share with you a story that, to me, epitomizes the potential of what I think you're dealing with here today. I was on the land board before we made these changes, and inadvertently, our power company had built a $44 million plant on school land instead of the land that they owned adjoining it. So two young men came in from the power company and explained to the land board, "You see, we have a little bit of a problem. We accidentally built our plant on your molehill instead of our molehill. So the solution is really quite simple. We'll just trade molehills, and then our plant will be on land that we own. And the chairman of the land board at the time was a big rancher from the northern part of our state with arms that were just massive. And when these young men finished, he just banged on the table. I thought the table was going to crack, and leaned across and said, "It may have been a molehill. It's a gold mine now." Needless to say, the president of the company came on the next visit to explain the issue. But I think that is how I felt in Utah when we first started this process, that we were talking about a molehill, and a lot of people didn't want to talk about it because they said, "Hardly makes any money for schools. Why are we even talking about this?" But we had some people who caught the vision of what it could do. Lily Eskelson was the president of our education association in our state. She is now the vice president for the National Education Association. But she caught the vision, and she said, maybe that's the problem. Maybe it should be making money for our schools, and it's not making it. Utah was in a far worse position than where you are right now in Minnesota. We had the smallest permanent school fund of any state in the nation. So small, we were less than a tenth of the next largest permanent fund. We were the poster child of how not to honor a trust, how not to run lands to benefit schools. The U.S. Supreme Court has called this trust obligation that states have on the school trust lands a sacred trust. Utah was not obeying that sacred trust. We were selling coal off of coal properties for a fraction of what the federal government was charging. One out of every three leases we issued, we gave the money to the wrong trust fund on that. We were selling land. I recall that we sold some land on a lake, and I asked the young man who was responsible for it, "Why did you sell that land for $25 an acre?" And he said, "Well, I couldn't charge any less than that. It said $25 or up in the state code." We were within the Department of Natural Resources. There were all sorts of conflicts of interest. We had state parks that were built on school trust land with no compensation to the school children whatsoever. We had hunting occurring on our trust lands with no compensation for the hunting on the trust lands. We had a timber production occurring. An audit had indicated there was no subsidy of the timber production. And then when the separation of the two agencies occurred, they had to come in and say, "No, we guess that $1 million a year that should have been going to the schools has been going to that subsidy." So it was a difficult situation. I have listened to leaders in your state talk about how difficult this problem is. I want you to know, I feel your pain. I know where you are, because when we first started out, we had, in opposition to what we were doing, we had our Association of Counties who were opposed. We had our ranching community that thought we were part of No Moo by 92 or Cattle Free by 93. We had opposition from the oil and gas companies, the coal companies, the environmental community. Every major group that was in our state was in opposition to making any sort of change. We studied it in Utah. We had a two-year task force that was totally legislators that studied the issues, and followed that with a third year of study by a citizen committee, all of whom came to the same conclusion. And I think the turning point was when those who were involved suddenly realized, this is a trust. It is a matter of honor. We have been given these incredible lands in our state for the support of our schools. And we as a state had spent 100 years dishonoring that, had sold half the land, and only had $18 million to show for having sold 3.5 million acres. When those involved began to understand that it was an issue of honoring a trust that began, the concept of this trust began in 1785. And every state in this union once had school trust lands or a permanent fund, including the original 13 colonies. They weren't granted federal lands because there were no federal lands in the original 13 colonies, but they granted themselves lands from tax forfeitures and all in order to build a school fund. The task force, as it looked at things, concluded that we had a situation in our governance where we had divided loyalty. We were asking people to be loyal to too many different issues instead of undivided loyalty, as is expected of a trustee. We did not have much accountability in our state. The records were maintained in such a manner that it was impossible to really tell exactly where the money was coming in and where it was going out. And there was no transparency. The changes that we're going to address today came out of those realizations that we had those fundamental problems of divided loyalty, no accountability, and no clear mandate of what should be occurring. Kevin will address the changes that occurred in our management of the lands themselves. But I will reiterate to you, we went from making less than $20 million a year on the same lands to making, last year it was 140-something million. The year before that it was 160-something million. While preserving the environment and improving the protection of archaeological resources and other very important aspects of those lands. I will address the two other issues that we dealt with. Our permanent fund, when it was $18 million, was invested for liquidity. It was a permanent fund, and yet it was invested in such a way as to always be liquid in case somebody wanted to take some of it. The return was very low on our permanent fund. We have made some changes. Constitutionally, we have a state treasurer who has the responsibility to invest the permanent fund. But we made the change of having an investment advisory committee that's comprised of the smartest investment people we have in our state that provide advice to that state treasurer on how that fund should be managed. I am pleased to tell you, I'm displeased to tell you, as of 18 months ago when the markets fell, ours fell also. We looked at how other endowment funds fared. Harvard University may take as long as 100 years to recover their fund to where they were because of they were not prudent in the investments that they made. Our trust fund, I'm pleased to tell you, has recovered, and we're now larger than we were when the fall occurred. And I believe that's because of the advice from this investment advisory committee. I think that's very important. You're not just concerned about making the money to get it into the permanent fund, but you want that permanent fund to be invested prudently and profitably. And we really stress both of those words being done at the same time, prudent and profitable. The other thing that we did is, like Minnesota, all of our money that we had been making from our school lands, we were putting into the education pot. And we were spending the money as fast as we were making the money, but no one could point to anything that was improved in education because that trust belonged to the schools of our state. And so what we do in Utah is all of the net revenue that's made from the land is deposited in the permanent fund, and then the interest and dividends go out to the schools. But the capital gains stay in the fund to grow the fund so that its impact on schools will increase over time, not decrease over time. The program we instituted is called the School Land Trust Program. And if you want to see more information about it, it is totally transparent. It's on the web under schoollandtrust.org. This program takes the money and it sends it out to every single individual school. Every school has what we call a school community council. So parents are elected by parents, teachers are elected by teachers, and the principal. And that committee looks at their test scores and determines the area of academic focus that they need to focus on as a school, then they develop a plan that will work for their school community. This has built a community of 8,000 people who not only care how well the treasurer does on his investment, but they also work to support what the land manager does on the lands and to make sure the lands are taken care of properly. It allows local control, local decision-making. When you go to that website, you will be able to see exactly how much money any school that you enter has received every single one of the years and exactly how that money was spent in that individual school. The individual plans have to be academic, and they're approved by the local school board. So you have some checks and balances on how the money is used. But it has made a tremendous difference in our state. When we first started in the 1970s and 80s, there was no recognition that there even were school lands in our state. Now, when the last survey that we did, 75% of the people know about school trust lands and what those lands are doing in the schools. So it has made an enormous difference. We have gone from a molehill to a gold mine. The fund is now over $1 billion, and it is making a real difference in the education of every single child in our state.
Thank you, Ms. Bird. Anybody have any questions that they want to deal with right now?
Oh, Mr. Sherman.
Senator Deal.
Ms. Bird, are some of the lands that you've got ranch lands or farmlands that you're renting out at a better rental rate than you were before?
Ms. Bird.
I believe there is not any, and this is probably an issue that Kevin or Mr. Carter can answer, but I cannot think of, and I do a lot of research into exactly what happens on revenue coming out of that agency. I can't think of a single area in which we aren't making more money now than we were. And I also have to tell you that ranchers are just so supportive of what has occurred, because now they have an agency that they can work with that will allow them to put in a watering system, that will allow them to do the things that they need to do to make that land more productive. But we struggle in our state over simple things like guzzlers for the wildlife, where sometimes the federal government won't let us put the guzzlers in. And in a dry state like Utah, if you don't have that, the wildlife can't survive. So I think that we make more money on every single area. The only thing I can think of is
Ms. Bird, you got to tell us what a guzzler is.
Oh, it's just this little thing down on the ground that kind of bubbles up some water so that, you know, an elk that's really thirsty that's in an area of the state, we don't have water like you do. We don't have very many streams, and, you know, our rivers are pretty condensed.
No flooding either, I bet.
Yeah. It is rare for it to flood. And so it provides a place where an animal can get something to drink without dying if it's trying to move from one drainage to another drainage.
Good. Senator Deal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bird, do you know what the – are you renting the ranch land out on a per-acre basis, or so much per animal unit per month, or how's that going?
We don't have a lot of agricultural land because in Utah we settled the state 50 years before we got statehood. And so many of the school lands that would have been ranch lands, that would have been agricultural lands, had already been settled by pioneers. We primarily have grazing lands, and most of our grazing lands are leased. But I am constantly told by ranchers how much they appreciate the change because they have an agency that will work with them. And part of what that agency does is it has a small portion of the revenue they make that creates a fund that ranchers can then borrow from that fund in order to improve the productivity of the land. But we don't have the beautiful agricultural lands that you have in the southern part of your state, on the whole.
Senator Deal.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bird, you started your speech out by talking about this rancher banging his hands on the table and talking about the gold mine he had, and you ended your speech talking about the gold mine you've got. What happened to that dispute with the rancher and those two 40-acre parcels where they built the facility on the wrong 40?
Ms. Bird.
What happened on that one was We had a choice between driving a title company out of business because of the size of the loss that they were going to have on that. And so we made an exchange for some urban property that the power company had that was in a very expensive portion of our state, a little town called Alpine, where property values are very high. Then we ultimately sold that piece of property. So we did all right. We didn't make $44 million. That's what you're asking.
Other questions for Ms. Bird? All right, great. Thank you for that. And should we turn it over to Mr. Carter? Mr. Carter, identify yourself for the record, will you please, and go ahead.
Thank you.
We look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Kevin Carter, and I'm the director of the Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration. Assuming that you've had a copy of this or have had a... This, of course, shows the land ownership in the state of Utah, where yellow is federal land administered by the Bureau of Land Management, green is national forest, purple is national park, orange is Native American reservation, pink is military installations, blue, that is checkerboard throughout, that are school trust lands. There are about 50 or so larger blocks, you can see, of more sizable areas of school trust land also interspersed throughout the state. The state of Utah is 67% owned by the federal government.
Wow.
So a significantly different paradigm than you have here. Although I understand there are counties in northern Minnesota that approach that, if not exceed that level of federal ownership. But when Utah came into the Union in 1896, the federal government offered a land grant of 4 sections in every township. Minnesota received 2 sections in every township. States that came in before Minnesota received only 1 section in every township. Fundamentally, it was a function of the productivity, the agricultural productivity of the land as you moved westward across the country, determined how generous the Congress was in making land grants. They concluded by the time they got out to the Great Basin that maybe 4 sections would be as fertile and productive as 1 section in Ohio. I think they overestimated the fertility in Utah. But the other thing that's important to recognize is that at the time the grants were given, it was only a surface grant. It did not include the minerals. And the mineral estate did not come to on the school lands until the 1920s, when it was subsequently conveyed to all of the states, the minerals underneath the lands that they had. Both states, if they had sold the surface, allowed the minerals to just flow on through to whoever the surface buyer was. That was the case in Utah. And so a lot of lands that we sold early on in statehood, the minerals passed through us to the private party who purchased the land from us. I don't know whether that was your situation or not, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was. Since that time, since the 1920s, federal law and state law prohibits us from from selling the mineral estate. So whenever we sold land, we retained the mineral estate, which has led to the situation where we have 3.5 million acres where we own both the surface and the minerals, and an additional 1 million acres where we only own the mineral estate and the surface is private. If I could take just a few minutes, what I'd like to do is present a before and after picture, 1994 and before, when we had a land management model, and then since that time when we changed. Prior to 1994, we had an executive director of a Department of Natural Resources. The Department of Natural Resources was an umbrella department that managed lands, wildlife, state parks, regulated oil, gas, and mining, geological survey, and several other typical resource management type entities. The executive director was appointed by the governor. Essentially, it was a cabinet level position in the governor. And then he He hired a director for each of the agencies. He hired a director for the Division of State Lands and Forestry, which managed the trust lands along with other state lands. Monies that came in from state land operations were used to pay for anything that the agency did, including non-school activities like forest management and sovereign land management. Pretty much the agency was established under the federal model, land management agencies, where agencies are responsible for managing for multiple uses and taking into account every potential use and user on the property, instead of focusing on a trust relationship for the schools, which is what the lands were granted for. In 1994, a significant change. The legislature changed the entire format and pulled trust land management out of the Department of Natural Resources, set it up as a standalone agency, established it in vernacular of the Utah Code, a quasi-independent state agency, which is an agency that's created by the legislature but which does not report directly to the governor. And so it's semi-independent in that way. We still come back to the legislature for appropriation for our budget, although we are entirely self-funded and only funded from our revenues. We've chosen to, in our paradigm, to set up four groups within the agency to manage the four major income sources that we have: gas, surface, such as grazing and farming, real estate, and hard rock and coal. I could refer back to a question that was raised previously. Most of our lands are permitted for grazing. We charge by the AUM. As you can tell from the map, many of our lands are islands in an ocean of federal ownership. And so the federal grazing fee served for many years as the basis for what we charged on trust lands. But we engaged the land-grant university in the state, Utah State University, do research on what would be a fair market value return on grazing fees. They compared private rentals, took into account the fact that we're surrounded by huge comparable in the federal government, and came up with a different fee. Right now we are $3.95 per AUM on the scattered sections and approaching $7 per AUM on the large blocks of. Private rates in Utah now are probably $10 to $12 per AUM. Private landowners are selling. BLM and the Forest Service sell an AUM for $1.35 this year, I think. We're on the low end of the middle, but roughly in the middle, pure private and the federal government. As the director, I'm appointed by the Board of Trustees for a four-year term. When the appointment is made, the governor has to concur in the appointment. But after that, I don't serve at his pleasure. And he can't fire me for any reason. I serve for the Board of Trustees. The focus is exclusively on using the lands to generate revenue for the school system, for the beneficiaries. And one of the things that we were created, the legislature instructed us to go out and act like a business and not like government. One of the things that we have systematically done over years is given employees the opportunity to move from a civil service job to an at-will position. We've induced them to do that with higher salary. But all of the non-clerical positions in the agency have now migrated over to at-will positions. So very, very closely aligning with the business model. There have been several Supreme Court rulings in Utah defining what our management objectives should be, and essentially they've said that this trust is the same as if you were to set up a trust for your children or your grandchildren. The same standard of fiduciary and duty that you would expect in that trust is what you should expect in this trust. You should manage these lands for the financial support of the beneficiaries with no subsidies to anyone else, with undivided loyalty. And so that has set foundation for how the lands are managed. Other states' courts have similar rulings on trust land management. And the U.S. Supreme Court has a similar ruling on trust land management. Actually, several. Since we were created in 1994, if you were to extend this graph to the left and go back to 1974 or maybe even to 1954, the column would be about the same place. 40 years or so before 1994, revenues hovered between $10 and $20 million a year. Since 1994, we've increased it. Last year, as Ms. Bird mentioned, we're about $140 million a year. The permanent fund started to accrue revenues in 1898, which was when we first became a state and started managing the lands and essentially selling, for the most part, the lands and putting the money into a permanent trust fund. From 1896 to 1995, the permanent fund had accrued about $50 million. We set a goal around 2000 to be at $1 billion by 2010. And when we closed the books December 31st, 2009, we were at $1,023,000,000 change. And so we were thrilled with the progress that we were able to make over that period of time. Many people were concerned when the switch was proposed in 1994 that with a focus on exclusively managing the lands for the beneficiaries, that all other interests would be neglected or abused. And I would like to report that that hasn't been the case. One of the areas that we pay particular attention to is cultural resources. In a state like Utah, we have a significant amount of cultural Native American type of resources, running the gamut from lithic scatters, which is a place where a roving band may have stopped and chipped off a few flakes from a rock, all the way to hovenweep or something of that category. This particular slide shows a world-class petroglyph called the Hunter Panel, which is located on school trust lands. And this panel was so close to a roadway that went right in front of it that a wide mirror on a truck could scratch it. So it was at risk. We partnered with an oil company, the county, and the historical preservation folks, and developed this facility around it to both protect it and allow people to look at it and view it and enjoy it. And just to demonstrate that just because your focus is on generating revenue, that doesn't mean it's to the exclusion of everything else. Any laws of universal applicability apply equally to us as they do to anyone else. And if there's a law that requires protection of cultural resources, we comply with it and make sure that they're protected.
Mr. Carter, can you move your microphone just a little closer? Thank you.
Any better?
Perfect. Thank
okay.
You.
Now that I've done that, I'm going to pull away for a second because I wanted to point something out on here.
I would swear this is the Kool-Aid man.
I have to admit, I don't really have any skills in interpreting rock art panels, but. other areas that we have to focus our attention on is endangered species. Under the Federal Endangered Species Act, animals are protected regardless of the landowner. Yeah. So animals that occur on school trust lands are afforded the same protection as they're afforded on federal lands or actually on private lands. The protection is the same. Plants are different. Plants under the Endangered Species Act from the federal government are only protected on federal lands. Any plants that's on the endangered species list that might be in your backyard, you can continue mowing it with a lawnmower and you're not violating the law. Might be some moral problems with that doing that, but it's not illegal. So where we have these types of resources on trust lands, we look for ways to to move those lands into some other ownership. We recognize that we're not the people that should be the repository of these resources, because in the long term, we're not set up to offer them the protection that they need. But the advantage of being a perpetual trust is that I've got a lot of time. I've got 3.5 million acres. There's no way that I can focus my attention on every acre every day. So there are a lot of acres that I can put on the back burner, acres that have this plant on it, for example. I don't have to deal with this today. I can leave it in a protected, unused condition until someone can come along who can acquire it from me and give it the protection that it needs. And so it's not at risk, even though my mandate is to use these lands to generate revenue. Other opportunities out there are perhaps more creative. This critter is the Utah prairie dog that is endemic to three counties in southern Utah. It's been on the endangered species list since the 1970s, early on. It was one of the earliest animals that were listed. Its habitat now encircles an urban area in southern Utah that during the last real estate boom was growing quite rapidly. But growth came to an absolute standstill because of habitat for the Utah prairie dog. And so in order to get past this roadblock, this standstill, we made land available in another area, land that was suitable as habitat for the prairie dog. We prepared the land so that it was conducive for their needs. In other words, you can't have high vegetation in prairie dog habitat because they have to be where they can see raptors flying about above them. Otherwise, they quickly become a meal of any bird passing by. So the area has to be prepared somewhat to make it habitable. Also, we discovered that you can't just turn them loose and hope they dig a hole in a hurry and survive. You actually have to create housing projects for them, if you will, that require about a 6-inch in diameter PVC pipe at the surface so that they can drop down out of sight long enough to escape badgers that would otherwise dig them out. And so you put a PVC pipe there, they can get down the ground, and then they dig their homes. But we made this land available. We worked out a habitat conservation plan with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service so that people that wanted to develop their land in the urban areas could pay a fee to have the prairie dogs relocated to the land that we had preserved for them. And we charged $2,000 per dog for this service, and it was a win for us, it was a win for the prairie dog, and it was a win for the private landowners. And I guess at the end of the day, the message is if you try hard enough, you can find a way to satisfy a mandate to generate revenue for the schools without throwing everything else to the wind. You can accomplish all of those objectives if you work at it. We have sensitive lands in Utah. This is what I think the boundary waters would look like in a million years with no water.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
If you're patient enough, you can enjoy this. This particular arch is on school trust land in Utah. It's difficult to get the perspective for how big this arch is, but if you go to Moab, which is where this is nearby, you will see pictures on restaurant walls of an airplane flying through this arch. No accounting for common sense, evidently, but it is a big arch. There's no question that we are not the ultimate long-term owner of this piece of property. Someone else should own this piece of property because we don't have the resources or the wherewithal to manage a park. And that's just not us. That's not what we do. So we work with the federal government. We work with private conservation groups like the Nature Conservancy, and we move these sensitive lands out of our ownership and acquire other lands instead. And since the late 1990s, we have moved about 500,000 acres of land out of our ownership and into either federal or ownership from some other state agency or conservation group who has a mandate that's more appropriate for owning these types of resources. We've done it at fair market value. We've done it without violating our fiduciary duty, and we've done it developing good relations with these other entities. Land exchanges with the federal government are time-consuming and require a great deal of patience. There is a classic anecdote in the West that the last piece of paper that you find in a BLM land exchange file is the applicant's death certificate. But if you are patient enough, you can make a land exchange work, and to your advantage, to everybody's advantage, or else they don't work. I think that's it for my prepared presentation, but we would be happy to respond to any questions.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Carter and Ms. Bird, both of you. Really interesting and lively. We appreciate that. Just maybe kind of in a nutshell, tell us why you think you've been successful at generating more revenue. What's the real reason? I mean, is it a long list of reasons, but, you know, what is the nugget that we should get out of this about how to be more focused on successfully raising revenue?
Well, I think, Madam Chair and members, I think the word you said was the key, and that was focus. Mm-hmm. We changed our focus to recognize that it was a trust. And one of the things that takes a while to recognize is that the trust obligation is a switch. It's not a valve. It's either on or it's off. It's not on a little bit, on a little bit more, or off. And once you come to that recognition, then you do everything else recognizing that.
And so you had a lot of land that was either it just wasn't charging enough money. It was underutilized. And you had other lands that weren't raising any revenue at all. So part of it was recognizing opportunities that had been ignored. Is that the case?
Madam Chair and Committee, I think it's also the ability of this agency. They have got to hustle. In the old days, I would ask for information, and I might wait 9 months to get the information. At that point, the question was no longer being asked. And now when I call over there and I say, I need such and such, the usual response is, would noon be soon enough? Do you need it right now? And so they are far more focused on exactly what they need to do, and they are actively going out and looking for productive uses of the lands. We've heard a lot about renewable resources, and the agency has been doing some very creative things, such as developing what we call an energy hub, where they create large cylinders, massive cylinders in a salt deposit, vertical cylinders, where they can, when demand is low, but the coal-fired power plant is still producing energy, they can put the compressed air into the ground so that then at high peak they can use it. Because, you know, electricity is not something you can just put in a box and store it until you need it again later. And they also, it will allow us, not solar, but wind energy has a difficult position in our economy because it only works when the wind's blowing. And so it will allow the wind energy people and companies to put some of the wind energy in compressed air down into the ground if there's not high demand at that point, and then be able to pull it back out when there is peak demand, which then makes the wind energy more efficient and better used. So they're into a lot of things that I don't know if they had still been run like a government agency, they would even be thinking about. So I think that's another source of the revenue.
And in terms of the structure, I can't remember how, if you said how the director is, so the governor does not appoint the director. Is there a board that hires them, basically? How does that work?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Committee, there is a board, and I'm appointed by the board.
That's you, so.
Okay. Yeah. The board appoints me for a four-year term, and although technically it's a four-year term, I serve at their pleasure. If I failed to perform, they wouldn't have much trouble getting rid of me, even though it's supposed to be a four-year term. The Board of Trustees is appointed by the governor. It's a seven-person Board of Trustees. One person is appointed by the governor at large, and it's usually someone from his staff. And that person acts as the conduit between our agency and the governor's office. The other six members are appointed for staggered six-year terms, and they are appointed from a list that the governor receives from a nominating committee. And so this nominating committee interviews potential candidates and then submits the governor a list of two people that he can select from to make an appointment to the board. The nominating committee is composed of representatives from the Board of Education, commodity interest groups, and conservation groups.
Okay. And then what is the budget of the agency?
About $9 to $10 million this last fiscal year.
Okay. And your management costs for the lands are part of your – are you able to access the – is it the corpus of the fund? Or how do you pay for management? Is that out of the income then?
The legislature appropriates from our income for us to use.
So it's all internally balanced.
It is.
All right. I saw a number of hands. I saw Senator Fredrickson, Dill, Sachs, Hagenbach. Go ahead, Senator Fredrickson. I think you were
Madam
first.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carter, what's your relationship with the divisions of your Department of Natural Resources? I'm assuming it's Department of Natural Resources. If you have forest land that's under your control and you're managing that, do you contract with the Department of Natural Resource or Division of Forestry or whatever the makeup is in Utah? And how is that relationship established?
Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, when we were separated from the Department of Natural Resources, we were given the option of contracting with them or contracting with anyone else to perform forestry functions that we needed done. We did not have a forestry staff. We had a range staff and other staff, but we did not have a forestry staff. We contracted with them for a couple of years, and then we hired in-house forestry staff to do the forestry work that we do. And so that's how we ended up doing it.
So how big of a staff do you have?
Madam Chair, we have 70 people on our staff right now in four locations within the state, mostly in Salt Lake City.
Okay. Senator Dill?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Carter, getting back to this grazing rate, from what I understood you to say, on the federal land it was $1.35 per animal unit month, and on private land it was around 10 to 12. And for your land, you kind of picked a number in between depending on where the parcel was located. And I think you said $3.99 per animal unit a month up to maybe 7. Before you started doing this improved management, were you down closer to the federal rate at $1.35 per animal unit a month? And then you went to 4 to 7?
Yes. We were, for a long time, we were exactly at the federal rate, and then for about a decade, we were at the federal rate plus 40 cents, I think, is what our formula was. So whatever the federal rate was, plus 40 cents is what we charged across the board.
Okay.
It was not empirically established.
Well, it looks to me like you just for the grazing part of it, you must have tripled or quintupled your income from the grazing fees that you were charging, that you're currently charging compared to what you were charging.
We did, and we did that in conjunction with the livestock industry because we also improved what they got from us. We extended the tenure of the permits they received from us, plus we gave them more surety in the permits they had from us. And so they felt that was an acceptable trade-off for paying higher fees.
That's the fund they can borrow from.
Plus, we work in conjunction with them to do range improvement projects.
Senator Sachshaug.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carter or Ms. Byrd, We work hard on our forests up here, consolidating where we can with land exchanges and the like. I'm assuming you do that probably mostly with grazing land, but I'm aware that recently you had a successful land exchange with the federal government. You want us to tell us a little bit about that?
Certainly, Madam Chair and committee members. I've been involved in three major land exchanges with the federal government. The first one was in 1998. It was concluded in 1998. It actually began in the early 1990s. If you will again refer to the map that I distributed earlier, the purple colors there are national parks. We had lands inheld within Arches National Park. I realize this will be really difficult to see, but Arches National Park is this one right here, where this finger is. And those lands, along with lands in Capitol Reef National Park, had been captured for over 60 years when the park was created. And we had attempted to get those lands out of the park for decades and had been unsuccessful. And finally, in the early 1990s, we went back to Congress and got a bill passed that authorized the land exchange to get us out of the national parks, out of national monuments, out of the Indian reservations, and out of the national forests. And it set up a process, and we started working that process and quickly came to loggerheads with the federal government from their land appraisers. Their position was that a section inside Arches National Park that had an arch on it and a road to it was worth the same amount of money as grazing land outside the park. And we disagreed. And so we were going to court. This whole exchange was going to court to resolve valuation issues. And then right shortly after the lawsuit was filed, President Clinton boldly strode to the north rim of the Grand Canyon in Arizona and declared 2 million acres in Utah a national monument. And that action captured an additional 200,000 acres of trust land. And when that was brought to his attention, he instructed the Secretary of the Interior at that time, Bruce Babbitt, to get a land exchange going that got us out of these lands, and if there was any dispute in value, to err on the side of the state. And so with that impetus behind it, our governor and the secretary sat down and negotiated a land exchange. And we traded out the Grand Staircase Escalante is this huge purple part right down in the southern center of the state. 2 million acres is the size of the national monument. About 10% of it was trust lands. So they negotiated a land exchange. We traded out of about 450,000 acres, roughly. We acquired about 180,000 acres plus $50 million in cash plus three coal mines. And some of the land that we acquired in the exchange is this large blue block right here in the center of the state, which has a world-class coal bed methane deposit on it. And so we've benefited to the tune of several hundreds of millions of dollars from extracting the oil and gas from that parcel, gas primarily. So that was the first land exchange that we did. The second one, it's more difficult to see on this map, but if you look on the west part of the map in the center, you'll see some vertical strips where there aren't any of the blue trust lands checkerboarded within there. Those are wilderness study areas inside the Great Basin there. And the second exchange, we traded out of all of the scattered sections. It was about 125,000 acres inside of the wilderness study areas there. And in that exchange, we picked up the piece of property that Ms. Bird talked about that has the salt deposit on it for caverns, plus some other properties around the state that we've used for a number of different income-earning opportunities. And then finally, we just completed a congressional land exchange that the president signed in August that we're starting to implement right now. We have 360 days as of the middle of December to get the first phase of that done. It was about 45,000 acres of trust land in exchange for about 35,000 acres of federal land. The arch that I showed on on the presentation is one of the pieces that we are trading to the federal government. We'll pick up oil and gas land in a area where that kind of production is occurring in the state. We shall have to go through an appraisal process on this exchange, and I have a little bit of trepidation about how difficult this might be to pull off still, but exchange is not an easy thing to do.
Senator Saxhauger, we're going to have to finish this up in the next 5 minutes.
Madam Chair, I was just going to tell Mr. Carter and thank him and Ms. Byrd for giving us confidence that exchanges can be pulled off.
All right. Senator Bach.
Just quickly, Madam Chair, Mr. Carter, in the case where you did exchanges and you received an amount of cash, in addition to the acreage, did you ever use the cash to buy additional land, or did you put the cash in the trust? And kind of the same question where, in the case of the Gopher thing, where you did an exchange, I mean, have you made any effort to increase the amount of school trust fund land, or do you have a no-net loss provision, or do you normally do exchanges where some does have a higher and better use, or kind of what's the policy relative to those things?
Certainly.
Mr. Carter.
Madam Chair, Senator, we do not have a no-net loss policy, nor are we looking to increase our land ownership. We are transparent to acres of ownership. If I was offered $50 million instead of taking the money, I would take land. I would buy land with it right now. I mean, the market is so good right now that I think that any land purchase could outperform the investment portfolio. And I would buy urban properties, frankly. You know, as a manager of a land trust, I'd be looking at urban properties and perhaps even commercial properties into the portfolio. We have a real estate function in our agency. We bring our lands to the table and invite well-capitalized and qualified developers to come in and compete to partner with us. We develop subdivisions and other things and put the land on the market and split the proceeds. And so we have a background and an understanding in how to do those kind of things. We do it well enough that other agencies ask us to do their land transactions for them. Over the past 10 years, we've made $250 million on real estate transactions. And so I think it's a prudent thing, if you do it with discipline, that a land trust should be involved with.
Madam Chair, that's really interesting, because certainly our Department of Natural Resources doesn't manage our land for the benefit of the trust. It seems we manage it for some other purposes.
I'm very curious about your concept of buying urban land. You own land that has housing on it that is leased, or how does that work? It's still trust fund land.
Madam Chairman, it was trust fund land,
we
sold it.
You sold it for development.
Now, we still have some of the properties that were part of those developments included commercial properties, office buildings. We still own those, and we lease those out. Got a golf course, got a couple of ski resorts, a number of things like that we do lease out for a long-term income stream. But residential, we experimented with renting residential property in the late 1980s, 1990s, and it was not successful. We concluded that renting or leasing residential property was not a paradigm that people were comfortable with, and so we went away from it.
And there's a lot of risk involved with the further you get into those financial kinds of arrangements. So the foreclosure crisis could hit you. I mean, valuations have been dropping. Just two more quick questions, and we'll have to try to wrap up quickly, but
thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to remind Senator Bach that one of the main reasons that we didn't ever make anything in our school trust fund is because every dollar that we put in there, we supplanted, and the money went into the general fund.
But not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore. The Lynch Law took care of that.
Well,
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, the way I remember it in my early days as a legislator on our forested lands, the DNR in the holding account was basically taking all the money, and there was no money being deposited in the trust. Nobody was being a good steward of the trust fund lands, and the DNR was just simply using it as revenue to run the department. They're using the holding account, and basically there were years that $0 were put in.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, that's exactly right, but there was really no reason to stick it in there because then it would have just ended up in the general fund.
That's true.
Because it supplanted the money.
So that was the first thing that we did in this process of reexamining the trust fund management in the last couple of years was to pass a law saying that that would not be offset, that contributions to schools would not be offset by general fund reductions. So it's a net gain now. So that was really significant. Do you have any payments that have to be made to local governments when you acquire land, take them off the tax rolls, or any kind of payment in lieu of taxes law?
Madam Chairman, yes, the state of Utah has a state payment in lieu of taxes ordinance or statute that provides for a payment of about 60 to 65 cents an acre for every acre of trust land within a county that gets paid to them. The federal payment in Utah is probably 15 cents an acre. Greenbelt property tax in Utah is Greenbelt If a landowner is using his land for purely agricultural purposes, he can put it on what's called the green belt that keeps the tax rate, the property tax rate, at an agricultural level instead of what the property might be worth if he was to build homes on it. And so so under green belt, it's probably a dime an acre, 10 cents an acre is what the property tax would be. So we are magnitudes above what private property tax would be for mostly equivalent land. You know, most of our land is grazing, raw grazing land that we're paying payment in lieu of taxes
and
on.
Do you pay for that out of your trust fund revenues? That's from the state's general fund or
it comes from federal
sources.
Mineral leasing funds.
But for the state? The state payments as well? Okay. And then you mentioned something about not getting any revenue from hunting lands. Do you charge people to hunt on lands now?
Our Division of Wildlife Resources makes a blanket payment for all of our lands to allow access for all citizens to hunt, trap, fish, and sightsee, I think, on there. Now, with the budget crisis that we face with most other states, they've only been making half payments this year and probably next year, but they have been making some payment.
Very interesting. Did you one last question, Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, Mr. Carter, on that same subject, approximately what is that payment for allowing open hunting?
Madam Chairman and Senator, it is it's on a 10-year agreement. It started out at $500,000 a year, and on year 10 it'll be a little over $1 million a year. We had an appraiser look at it, and he concluded that it was probably worth $1.25 million a year is what private landowners similarly situated would get if they hired somebody to manage the land and control hunting access.
All right. Very interesting. Thank you so much for being here. You have a very beautiful state, which many of us have enjoyed visiting. And thank you so much for sharing your experience. It's been really, really helpful for us.
Thank you all.
So thank you.
You have a beautiful state.
Thank you. We wish you had time to sightsee a little bit while you were here. But
I'm planning to do that tomorrow.
Great. Oh, it's going to be beautiful tomorrow. So good timing. Thank you very much. We do have three bills, members, so we need to keep moving. Senator Prettner-Solin.
It's a shame.
It's a crime.
You should be greater support.
Madam Chair, do you need this on any longer?
No, you can. I don't know if it has to. Yeah, just go for it. All right. Senator Prettner-Solin, welcome to the committee.
There was a bill going.
And Madam Chair.
Do you want your witnesses up with you as well?
Yes.
Commissioner Boyd and Dr. Haar. All right. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really noisy. I'm not sure if that Madam Chair and committee members, I'm here before you requesting a $1.6 million increase for the Public Utilities Commission for staffing needs. This increase will have no general fund impact. For years, the Public Utilities Commission has been operating with one of the leanest staffs in the country compared to other state utility commissions. However, because of significant increases in rate filings, growing regional and national demands, and increased needs for transmission planning, the PUC is in need of additional staff. We have hesitated making this recommendation for many years because of our state's fiscal situation. However, our state needs to have a voice at national and regional planning exercises. Our ratepayers need to have additional regulators carefully examining the growing rate filings, and the utilities need to be able to get a final decision on a rate case in a timely manner. Our PUC does an exceptional job with the staff that are currently serving. However, given the additional duties that are being placed on the commission, I urge you to consider this request. And, Madam Chair, I have an oral author's amendment, and that would just be to fill in the blank with $1.6 million.
So $1.6 million is what you want to insert in there?
Yes, and Dr. Boyd will explain why that amount is needed.
Great. All right, well, let's take the testimony, and then we can talk about whether we need to amend that in there. So, Commissioner, will you? Or you're the chair, correct? So I'll
yes.
call you Mr. Chair.
Call me anything you want, Senator.
Commissioner Boyd, why don't I call you that, just for simplicity?
Madam Chair and members
welcome
of the
to the committee.
Thank you. My name is David Boyd. I am the chair of the Minnesota PUC, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak today. This is perhaps not an easy topic for me or for others to bring up, but I think it's one that's worthy of some discussion. The issue of Dr. Hara is here with me, and while we don't have a slideshow with Prairie Dogs, Commissioner Pugh is over on the side, and he might pop his head up once in a while if you'd like him to. The issue of staffing at the commission is one that's been discussed internally for the past several years. In a nutshell, the size of the commission seems to be mismatched to its responsibilities, as I will describe in a moment. We came to this conclusion some time ago and did submit a staffing request in the early stages of development of the current biennial budget, but withdrew our request in light of the state's financial situation and in hopes that some of the issues that occupy our time would diminish in intensity. That, unfortunately, has not materialized. In essence, the PUC staffing level has not kept pace with its added duties, particularly with changes that have occurred in the last several years. I thank Senator Prettner-Solon for raising this issue and feel it is one worthy of your attention. In terms of the commission and the mismatch between workload and resources, I'll raise three examples of issues of note, in my mind at least. The first is rate cases. These are formal proceedings where a utility seeks to adjust their rates. They are 10 to 12-month elaborate formal contested proceedings that occupy a significant amount of time for all parties, including the Attorney General's Office, the Office of Energy Security, the Commission, and the utilities. There were a few of these filings made in the 1990s, but that number has increased rather dramatically in the last few years. We made do in the first burst of rate cases. We had a lot of people working late nights and weekends, and we were hoping that we would ride through the crest of rate cases, but that has not been the case. There are now about three to four of these filed a year. At the moment, we have four that are in active process, two that are at the end of their process, and there'll be two more filed in April. And I think that will be a new record, having eight active rate cases in the state. A second workload issue comes from expanded responsibilities that have come from several different areas. The first example would be the 2005 transfer of siting and routing responsibility to the Commission for Large Energy Facilities. And with a major build-out in infrastructure anticipated in the coming years, that's a group that will be extraordinarily busy. The second responsibility cluster came from the Next Generation Energy Act in 2007, where we assumed a sizable amount of responsibility for renewables, energy efficiency, conservation, renewable energy certificates, the REC market, decoupling, and so on.
And the third area is the emergence of the Regional Grid Authority, the Midwest ISO. That's an entity that requires a great deal of monitoring from our standpoint. States in our neighboring states have as many as 6 staffers working on that one issue alone. We have staff from our agency and OES working at probably less than half that level, trying to keep up with the developments of that entity. And the third workload issue is one that's ongoing. It's transmission planning. That happens in sub-regional level. We have a 5-state group that's working on transmission planning to move renewables sufficient to meet renewable energy standards. There is a Midwest ISO-wide footprint process going on, talking about transmission planning and the important issue of cost allocation. And we're now, with ARRA funding, embarking boldly on a Eastern interconnect-wide planning process that will involve all the states east of the Rock?
Central time zone.
Central time zone east. 40 different jurisdictions trying to talk about planning. We've done a number of things to try and keep our process under control. We've streamlined some of our processes. We've moved staff around as tasks have ebbed and flowed. We've added electronic resources to significantly increase the efficiency of the agency, but we're essentially at the end of those opportunities. Our staff per capita in the United States is 47th. The staff size of states with comparable populations to Minnesota is 124. If you take the PUC staff and the OES staff and combine them, it's about 85. Wisconsin has a staff of 153 for comparison's sake. So the bill that has been introduced would seek to add 15 positions to the commission. Those would be analysts, financial analysts, policy analysts. There would be some internal support work with the Consumer Affairs Office, order writer, an accountant, information technology, and engineering expertise to the commission. And as Senator Pretner Solon pointed out, while there is cost to the ratepayers in enlarging the commission, it is not a general fund issue in the sense that about 97% of our general fund allotment is returned through our assessment process. We're very aware of the impact to ratepayers. It is one of our prime functions to minimize or mitigate impact on ratepayers. But our fear is that if we aren't able to take some kind of action and complete our work, that our obligation to ratepayers, utilities, and policymakers will become increasingly difficult to meet as we stand today. So with that, I will stop, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Dr. Hart, did you want to speak?
Madam Chair, I'm basically here for questions. Okay. I have nothing further to add. Thank you.
So I'm trying to understand this 97% recovered. Where does the other 3% come in? Because we don't have a general fund appropriation, as far as I know. Dr. Hart.
Madam Chair, our budget is, of course, approved through the normal process, and there are cap limits on our ability to recover for the general fund. We have assessment authority, and we recover virtually all of our expenditures through that assessment authority. On occasion, we will run into instances where one particular company there, if our assessments against them go to exceed, I think it's 2/5 of 1% of their gross operating revenues, then we can't go beyond that. So that's we run into that on rare occasions. So we can't say that we recover 100% because, as I say, in a few instances, those caps come into play. But by and large, it's a very significant percentage of the revenues recovered.
And so what happens if you don't fully recover?
That money just does not go back to the general fund. All the monies we recover just go directly to the general fund. Our budget is approved. Like every other state agency, it's just that it's fee funded and the general fund is replenished through our assessment process.
Okay, so we're estimating we'd have to book a very small general fund cost for this, just to accommodate that.
Madam Chair, to cover the approximate 3%, yes, mm-hmm. That's right.
And Senator Pretner Solon, you and I have talked about this a number of times. We've talked about it in your committee, the need. I think there's pretty strong agreement that there's more staff needed to do the work that the PUC is doing. I'm wondering how you came up with the 15 staff.
Perhaps, Madam Chair, we asked the PUC what would be the recommended number of staff that would be appropriate to add at this time, and maybe they can respond to why that occurred.
Sure. Commissioner?
Madam Chair, we simply talked as a staff and as commissioners about where our greatest gaps are, where we're most deficient, and we started counting noses and tallying them up. I would say it was not a perfectly scientific process, but it wasn't hard to do at the same time. If you look at the activities of the commission, finding engineering expertise, as an example, was a fairly simple matter. Estimating the full number of rate analysts is a little bit trickier, but we think that it's our best guess, I guess, is the answer.
And the, these are the all 15 positions that you mentioned. Are these pretty much all existing positions that you have, or some of them are new? Do you have an accountant already? I mean, and the pay, I'm wondering about the pay grade for these positions. Would they be the same as existing ones?
Madam Chair, I'll let Dr. Hart talk about the pay grade. These are all examples of individuals that are on the staff. These are just more of the particular type of staff.
Madam Chair, members, that's right. The types of positions that that we've included in our tally here are positions that exist. Positions that exist currently. On our staff, executive assistants, policy assistants, rate analysts, engineering principals. Those are all existing classifications, and these would be new additional positions in those classifications.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Senator Prittner,
did you get a copy of this letter from the PUC that that really articulates why the positions are needed and the last page particularly shows what
that.
The salaries are.
Oh. Okay. And then, and I would want to be sure we're not talking about raising salaries at this time. I don't think that would be appropriate. I would want to make sure this money was being used for additional staff. But we're all under pay freezes pretty much across a lot of state government at this point, and I think that's as it should be given the budget.
Madam Chair, that's certainly our intent.
Commissioner. Okay. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you, the $1.6 million is an additional appropriation to your existing budget, and I don't recall what the size of that budget is. What percentage increase does that represent?
Dr. Hart.
Madam Chair, current budget is about $5.4 million. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Hand,
if your current budget is $5 million and you're going to increase it by an additional 20% growth?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's I believe that's the math, right, approximately. You have to remember that we have a staff of 42, which, as Commissioner Chair or Commissioner Boyd indicated, it ranks on a per capita basis 47th out of the 50 states. We have a staff size about the same as North Dakota.
Madam Chair and Mr. Hart, I appreciate your point. I'm just a little concerned about in this time when we're not, as far as I know, talking about increasing anybody's budget, looking at a 20% increase seems a little much, and I appreciate the point that you're making that the staff size might be smaller compared to other states and so forth, but I guess the other part of my question is, is these all recovered by increases in rates? Is that how the fees are recovered, rates to payers?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, we, as I was mentioning, we have authority to do assessments, to assess the utilities for the services, basically, that we provide them, we all keep track of our time we spent on the various dockets, and it's a fairly elaborate process, but that is how these funds are recovered for the general fund. That's correct. And that is recovered through rates.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if maybe we shouldn't reduce this by some amount. I don't, 20% is a pretty big bump in anybody's budget.
Senator Prittner-Solin.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Hand, you also have to recognize that they've been under a freeze themselves for many, many years, and yet the demands that we placed on them through our mandates in the legislature have increased their workload significantly. I think that you will find that $1.5 million is really a, while it's a significant number, that it's a very, very small amount that would be added onto a ratepayer's rates when you spread it across the entire state for the variety of different utilities that are offered, and for the number of different residences and businesses and everything else that are going on, facilities that there are.
When was the last time you hired additional staff?
Madam Chair, I'm having trouble remembering, actually. It's been several bienniums. I would have to go back and look.
Okay.
In terms of adding new positions,
yes.
Which I assume is your question, right?
Do you have any federal mandates that are requiring you to have additional staff, or is it?
Madam Chair, the closest thing to a mandate is our participation in this DOE-funded group, Department of Energy-funded group, to look at planning the Eastern Interconnect. That group, though, will be, the travel costs will be covered through the grant, but the time of the participants will come out of our allotment. That would be the only example.
Commissioner, I was just curious, how do your salaries get set?
Our salaries, I understand, we're in a clustering of salaries that are a percentage of the governor's salary, and so those have not changed for something on the order of 15 years, if I understand correctly.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I think they're set by the same body that sets the legislative salaries.
Can we get ours pegged to the governor? I think that would help the legislature.
But the current language, Madam Chair, I'm also in that committee.
Oh, really?
Does peg it to the governor's salary, so.
Oh, it must be
Madam Chair,
a minuscule percentage. Yeah.
I may have misspoke a little bit. I'm sure the governor has to authorize a change in salary to our commissioners, but we don't move as the governor's salary moves. We have a cap that is a percentage of the governor's salary. So unless the governor authorizes a change to our salaries, we stay flat.
I've kind of heard generally support from utilities for this idea, but I don't want to assume that. I want to ask if anyone would like to testify on this. Would anyone else like to be heard? Any of the utilities have an opinion they'd like to express publicly for or against this? I'm not seeing any rush to come up and speak to us, so. All right. Are there other questions?
Madam Chair.
Well, Senator Prettner-Solon, what we would do with this bill is lay it over for possible inclusion in our second omnibus bill.
Madam Chair, I would just like to say that we have been approached by several utilities saying that their rate cases take forever, and they would like it if the PUC had additional staff and they were willing to pay for that so that their rate cases could be heard more quickly.
Thank you for that information. That's what I've heard as well. I would say we don't have to put the dollar figure in here. We can take it under advisement as a committee, but we certainly hear your recommendation, and we'll consider that number in our bill. I guess that's something for the committee to make a decision on. But for now, if there's no further discussion, Senator Prettner-Solon would move that. No, you can't move
it. I can't, no.
Sorry. Would someone like Senator Rummel would move that Senate File 3082 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill? On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here with, I don't have the Senate file in front of me. Senate file 2845. And this is an issue that came to me this last fall by the township of Washkish. small community up on the east shore of Upper Red Lake. And they actually have two of these utility crossing permit fees in their township that has occurred this fall. One was somebody was building a house, and the line was going to go down the township road to the house, and there was a $5,000 fee there. Another one involved a bridge that was being rebuilt, and at the same time they were upgrading the bridge, they were going to upgrade the utility line that was also running down the road right away there. And they informed me that that was $5,000. I think they're probably mistaken there, because that would have been a water crossing. But irrespective of that, this little community of less than around 100 people was going to have between $7,000 and $10,000 worth of fees. And they thought that was a little excess, and I agreed with them. And originally when I brought this effort forward, I thought that perhaps, you know, as I made the argument for the unfairness of this on these jurisdictions that have a large amount of public land, that perhaps we could mitigate some impact on those jurisdictions. But as I've learned about this, I actually have come to believe that I don't think we need the department to do this, because the road authority has the jurisdiction on the roadway. The environmental impacts have all been mitigated when the road went through. And if you want to know where the line is, they can call Gopher One, and they'll come and paint the line. And so I got the fiscal note from the department of four full-time equivalents, $351,000. Got the DNR fact sheet. They do 200 water crossings and 35 land crossings per year, which I think 80-some percent of these are done utility right-of-ways, and 75 are water cross. 72% of the water crossings are on utility right-of-ways. I know this isn't a general fund savings, but it certainly appears to me to be a duplication of services that is going on here, and I'm pretty sure the department is going to come up and explain why they think they need to do this. But I really would like to emphasize that, you know, the state has this public land for the state people to utilize and to enjoy. It seems to me that if we are going to do it, it certainly should be a state responsibility, as opposed to just the people that happen to live where these lands are. And, you know, most of this land is in the state ownership because it was tax forfeit, which, when you think about why land becomes tax forfeit, most of it was such poor land that nobody could make a living there. And so these folks do not have the financial abilities to absorb these costs. So I would hope that you would give consideration to removing the fees and removing the responsibility of the DNR to monitor these utility lines. I think it's a reasonable request. And so, you know, while I'm bringing this forward at the behest of the Washkish Township, I have been contacted by other interested people, and I think some of those folks have traveled from northern Minnesota. I believe there's people here from the Beltrami Electric Co-op that might want to testify as to the impact to them. But I would hope that the committee would give consideration to my request, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Scoy. And members, if you looked at the fiscal note, it's in your packet. Remember, this was a governor's recommendation last year to add these fees to help make up for general fund cuts. And so, Senator Scoy, when we talked about it, that's my concern, is we got to figure out how to pay for this. We certainly understand the concerns that you're raising. But it's a large cost to our budget. Go ahead, and then why don't we bring your witnesses up to speak to us, and then the DNR.
Well, Madam Chair, if you relieve the DNR of the responsibility, they won't have to do this work.
Well, we'll ask them that question, if they can, what would happen if we did that.
Sure. I figured that they would come.
So please, welcome to the committee.
It's a governor.
Please identify yourself for us.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lynette Nusma. I'm general manager of Beltrami Electric Cooperative. We're headquartered in Bemidji, Minnesota. We serve 20,000 meters along 3,300 miles of line. I appreciate the opportunity to address you today and add my support to SF 2845. In 2009, as you know, supplemental application fees of $4,500 for land crossings and $1,500 for water crossings were added to an existing $500 application fee for utilities on state lands that are administered by the Department of Natural Resources. This 900% increase in fees was justified to, quote, cover reasonable expenses for reviewing the application and preparing the license. It is my contention that the original $500 application fee does cover reasonable costs for the application and processing of the license. Minnesota Electric Cooperatives also believe that this utility license in public road right-of-way may not be necessary. When utilities are placed within the public road right-of-way, the cost to DNR to license these crossings should be negligible. The Public Road Authority is authorized by law to allow utilities to place facilities within the public road right-of-way. This contention in the DNR easement is supported in the DNR easement to the Road Authority by the reference that, quote, the right-of-way was hereby conveyed shall be open to the general public, unquote. Placement of the utilities within the road right-of-way must conform to state laws and regulations to protect the public and the environment. Said another way, there is no need for the DNR to duplicate the existing work of the Public Road Authority. The Public Road Authority is required to pay the DNR for an easement for acquisition of road right-of-way. In addition to the easement fee, the Public Road Authority mitigates any impact to DNR protected waters in conjunction with road right-of-way improvements. Adverse impact to state lands are minimized or eliminated when utilities are located within the public road right-of-way. These fees charged to the utilities have the effect of compensating the DNR again for easement rights previously paid by the Road Authority. The DNR has expressed concern over time and manpower involved in locating utility lines, particularly those that are underground. Locating underground infrastructure is the responsibility of the Minnesota Gopher One Call. Beltrami Electric and other utilities pay for this service and bear the cost of those locates. Subsequently, there is no cost to DNR for location services should they need them. I understand that revenue loss requires an offset of expenses. The elimination of the DNR tracking utility lines along public road right-of-way would reduce the scope of the current activity, thus eliminating the need for that revenue. The reduction of this expenditure would not result in, quote, haphazardly placement of utilities with no record, unquote, as the DNR contends. This tracking is already monitored by the Public Road Authority. The 900% increase in DNR crossing fees must be passed on to our members and, in many cases, developers. These fees have the undesired consequences in a loss of development and further erosion of the county tax base. This tax base is already hit by lost tax revenue and likely further to be hit in reductions in payment in lieu of taxes. This is just one more impact of being a DNR neighbor and being asked to fund more than its share of the state resource, which is meant to benefit all citizens. Please understand that Beltrami Electric and the state's electric cooperatives do understand and appreciate that DNR has a difficult job to do, just as we all do in this economy. However, in the case of public road right-of-ways, the DNR is charging an additional supplemental fee for activity already monitored by the road authority. As Senator Scoy said, this duplication adds to the cost of service, and it also adds to our state budgets. Thank you for your kind consideration.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nusma, and appreciate your coming down to talk to us about this today. Are there questions? Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I'm happy to see the governor has supported this huge tax increase. But I my own co-op has complained about the same thing, that it's excessive. And I think when you see a fee go up beyond what the cost of providing that government service, that's kind of the definition of a tax. And you can see it in other fees, too, that we've got scattered throughout state government. My only question is, Senator Scoy, could I join you as a co-author on this bill?
You certainly can, Senator Dill.
And Senator Dill, have you heard complaints about this as well?
My co-op, Meeker County Light and Power Co-op, has brought it to my attention twice.
Well, I'm not surprised.
And it's kind of an amazing fee increase.
Let's hear from the DNR. Mr. Vadas, can you talk to us about this? And Ms. Nusma, you might need to come back, but don't go far.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Marty Vadas, and I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division for DNR. And I'd be open for questions, or maybe I could add a couple of comments, if that's all right.
Yes, that would be great.
I think the issue is repealing the application fee for utility licenses that would be within road right-of-ways, and I think it's important to understand where DNR does issue a utility license isn't for any utility in any road right-of-way. It's only where DNR owns the underlying interest. So there's a road that goes across DNR-managed land, and if there's an application for a utility license on that land, then there's a utility license issued, and that's under statutory authority. It's in the statute giving DNR the authority to issue those utility licenses. And, for example, if there is a stream crossing, and if that goes along a road right-of-way, that would be an example of a utility license within a road right-of-way. And we do have a fiscal note and do mention that there are options on how to eliminate this fee. And one would be to authorize that activity without there being approval or a utility license issued by DNR. And we're just pointing out that could potentially result in sort of a haphazard placement of the utilities with no record of where those utilities exist, and also no review of any potential impacts on the natural resources. So I also do have a fact sheet that does talk about the kind of work that's done by DNR on each of these applications. I'd be happy to share that, but in general, just, you know, goes through what normally a landowner would do, a big landowner, is figure out if we own it and take a look at what's being proposed. We do a review of what the impact potentially might be on natural resources, and sometimes do suggest alternatives to lessen that impact. We do a review to see if there's federal aid on the land, because if there is federal aid, this might be viewed as a reduction in the value by the federal agencies, and what's at stake there is future federal aid coming to Minnesota for natural resource land if we're not abiding by the reasons the land were originally acquired by the state. We also do a survey or review a survey so that this utility license can be recorded and we know where it is in the future. And sometimes do review and monitor construction activities, especially if it is through wetlands or in a stream bed. And we keep a record of this activity. And Chair is correct. Last biennium, the current biennium that we're in, the department's budget was reduced by $675,000. And that was for utility licenses and also road easements. And that was replaced by a fee. And there's $500 of an application fee that goes to the state general fund. There's the supplemental application fee. And as I understand it, the intention was to no longer have the state general fund support this sort of commercial or, in the case of private individuals, I guess, private activity. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the only thing I would say is that, you know, either the county or the township or the state has to place these utilities. I mean, the utility doesn't just get to go and put them wherever they want. And with regard to wetlands and stream beds, these are roads. They're road right-of-ways. It's not that's where the line is going. And for a utility, you know, I think it's general practice. They would just as soon not have their utilities in a road right-of-way, because if they have to move them, they have to bear the cost of that. But in these instances, they end up going on the road right-of-way. So I don't know. It just seems to me, you know, when I read this fiscal note, they recognize that it's not computerized, which I would think would be a significant increase in efficiency if they were. I mean, using GPS and computers for this would be a lot simpler. But they're already all this is being done by Gopher One. And if you want to know where the line is, you call Gopher One, and they'll come and tell you where the line is. And if they want you to paint it out, they'll paint it out. And they even give you depth if you're asking for it.
All right. So, Mr. Vadas, if I understand this correctly, you're saying the two alternatives without the funding would be either just let other people make the decision without the DNR keeping track of it, and without any decision about whether it's impacting the natural resource land, or just don't allow the crossing at all. Is that what the two options are that I'm
Madam
seeing?
Chair, that would be correct, and what we saw as alternatives to this. You know, either we stop doing this altogether, and that's one of the two that we issued. And the other choice is that if this fee isn't collected, then we don't have the people to work on issuing these, and then that would be another alternative, as the state stops issuing these. If we don't have the staff to do the work on the background and actually issuing a utility license, if that requirement to issue one still remains, then we stop doing it. So either we allow it to happen without any oversight or review or record keeping, or we stop doing it. So those are the two alternatives that we could come up with without that general fund support of this activity.
And what kind of records are you keeping on this, on these?
Madam Chair, we do track where these are located and keep them in our current record management system. And we are developing this new land record system, computerized land record system. And we're including provisions to track encumbrances like these utility licenses. And that will be available to anybody if they have any reason to look at it. But we are moving away from a paper copy sort of tracking to a computerized system tracking.
I think Senator Dill had his hand up.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, this morning we had a joint Senate Tax Committee, Finance Tax Committee meeting. We listened to Clark?
Walker.
Yeah. Anyway, he painted a very dismal picture. I was kind of discouraged after listening to him and how he talked about how bad the future really is for both state, federal, and local units of government. I just have to figure out ways to reduce what we do and cut down on different things and find ways to raise additional revenue and reorganize. And it sounded like it's a long-term, difficult task. And maybe this is just one little tiny step along the way, that maybe this is not really that important to have both the DNR plus the local utility keeping maps of where all this stuff is. Maybe one is enough. And isn't that kind of what it amounts to? We're keeping double records here. I mean, that's part of it. You want to, the DNR wants their records, but then the co-op has their records also as to where these lines are.
Well, I suppose if the DNR is trying to do anything with that land, they do need to know where the utilities are. You know, if they're going to go in and log it, they need to know where the lines are.
But they can ask Gopher One.
They can go ask someone else.
Or ask the co-op where it is.
Senator Scoy?
Madam Chair, these are down the road right-of-ways. There wouldn't be any activity going on there. You know, perhaps a snowmobile trail down the side of it would be the extent. Most of these are relatively small lines. I mean, if this is a major power transmission or some major utility, they won't be in the road right away because of the cost of moving it if the road gets improved. These would be relatively small, you know, a telephone line to somebody or an underground power line to a house or something would be what the majority of this is.
Well, Mr. Vadas, I guess it would be helpful for if you can maybe come back with a little more information at some point about, you know, what would be the harm specifically if you weren't going to do this anymore, because it seems like that's really the only option if we're going to take Senator Scoy's bill and move it forward. I'm not sure that I have enough understanding of what the detriment would be at this point. I mean, I understand the problem with these fee increases, but what would be the harm if we just took this off your hands? I guess we need to get – I'd like to have a little bit better answer on that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to bring that back.
That would be helpful. Thank you. And Senator Scoy.
Madam Chair, we had discussions a few weeks ago about this, and I actually did look at some of the impacts if we were able to kind of shift this around a little bit. And what happens for the power line, if it's a power utility, from my understanding – They only own the line to the property line, and so then they assess the property owner for their $5,000 fee. If it's a telephone line, then that they own the line all the way up into the house, and so then all the ratepayers end up paying that fee. And so I couldn't figure out any way reasonably that we could shift this off onto somebody who would have the wherewithal to absorb it. I just didn't come up with anything, and so the result that I – the conclusion I drew was probably would be best if they didn't have to do this. Hmm.
So there's nobody who's not paying right now. I think, Senator Scoy, what we should do is just lay the bill on the table for consideration, and we'll get a little more information and come back to it eventually. So would someone just make a motion? Senator Fredrickson would move to lay Senate File 2845 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator
Scoy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rummel has some witnesses here, and we really want to give them a chance to be heard and see if we can finish your bill. If we don't finish it, Senator Rummel, we'll just have to bump it to Thursday. But let's make sure we hear from the people who have been patiently waiting to speak to us. Senate File 2630.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I have a small author's amendment. I believe somebody has that. The author's amendment simply puts some of the language into the form that is consistent with what the DNR would like
to see. Okay, we're getting the amendment. We do have a fiscal note, but the amendment, it's on its way.
Okay, thank you. The amendment simply changes a couple words around. This is another fee issue, folks. The purpose of this bill is a modification of fees for control of aquatic vegetation on stormwater ponds. Carey Pond is a man-made drainage ditch that homeowners have cared for as part of their property over the years. Back in the 1950s, I believe, before the homes were built in this area, the land was wetland that had been drained for farming. In the 1970s and 80s, developers bought the land and turned it into residential neighborhoods. The drainage ditches and ponds that resulted served to capture stormwater runoff, so it didn't wind up in the wastewater systems of that era. These ponds are typically 20 acres or less, and they have been considered DNR lakes by the DNR and are subject to the rules and regulations from that agency. In 2006, the legislature required the DNR to adjust its fees so that the fees would cover all its costs for permitting. And Mr. Hirsch is here, and he'll go into that in a little more detail. The resulting rulemaking at the DNR has drastically changed the fees for the homeowners on stormwater ponds. Carey Pond is just one example. Currently, homeowners on this pond pay $750 for a group permit, which equals about $7 per household. Under the new rules, the new fee comes to $13,410. That's roughly an increase of 18 times what the original fee was. The cost per household went from $7 per household to $90 per household, which is 12 and a half times what homeowners used to pay. So my constituents are baffled. They wondered what it is that they receive for this $13,400 that is more than, at best, a once-a-year visit of 2 or 3 hours. As I understand it, the DNR currently raises about $300,000 a year, but needs to raise $1 million a year to cover its fees. In other words, the DNR needs to generate a little more than three times the amount of money it's currently generating. Remember, the homeowners on these pieces of properties are being assessed between 12 and 18 times what they were assessed, or what they're being assessed right now. So homeowners, as you can imagine, feel that they are being asked to pick up more than their share of the DNR's obligation to pay for its permitting. Mr. Hirsch graciously came and visited with the residents of Carey Pond last fall, and he was very, very good at explaining the difficulty he finds himself in. The new rulemaking for fees on aquatic fees are going to be very difficult to make, and he was arguing for simplicity, that one fee for everybody was probably the simplest way to go rather than to create all kinds of categories. But on the other hand, considering the size of these stormwater ponds and the fact that they're relatively efficient to service, our homeowners think that we could compromise. This bill proposes a two-tier fee, so it's still simple. For ponds under 20 acres, the fee is reduced to better reflect the compact nature of the ponds in relation to the number of households that border them. And folks, most of these stormwater drainage ponds are in the suburbs. It was during that era where the first ring suburbs were developing rapidly. And the impact of the fees are hitting these folks more heavily than elsewhere. As you can see by the fiscal note, there are only about 70 ponds, or 70 permits, I guess, that would be affected. And they represent only a small portion of the overall fund. The bill will not make a huge impact on others, but it will on my constituents who live on Carey Pond. I have with me Mr. Hirsch from the DNR and Mr. Ken McGurdy from Carey Pond. And I think I'll turn the mic over to Mr. McGurdy.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for us.
Ken McGurdy. I live in Shoreview and on the Carey Pond system up there, which is basically nothing more than a glorified drainage ditch. But we need to keep it clean to keep our weeds down, to keep our home values and aesthetics up. Otherwise, it would impact us. I'm a member of the association up there. I'm the treasurer up there. I have not worked directly with the DNR. Terry Neese does that. But I am familiar with a lot of the issues, and I know that raising these fees to the $90 per permit will probably drop us participation in getting the spraying done. It's baffling to most people to understand why it costs $13,000 to get a permit, or almost $14,000 to get a permit, when the spraying only costs $6,000. How many permits do you find that cost more than the actual service that you're getting provided? It's over double of what it is. I know that we'll drop off drastically in the participation of getting it sprayed, and it'll be difficult to keep the home values up with this new fee that goes on there. Most of the residents keep asking, what are we getting for this services over the last, I've been there for 23 years. Last year was the first time anybody ever came by to look at the weeds in the lake and to make some assessment. As a matter of fact, the DNR recognized an error that they had made, and were actually they classified us as three separate ponds. So this year, well, I think it's maybe next year, our fees will go to $750 per lake. So right now we're jumping at $2,250 just in the next year because of the way they classified it. Apparently somebody recognized their error, so it's a significant increase already to us. And then when you do this, put this $90 fee, which will probably come in what, 2 years, I think, then it goes sky high on us. Most of them are asking, what do we get for this? We don't get anything. We think we're a huge cash cow for the DNR. We're just supplying money into them so they can do their projects over on Lake Minnetonka, where all the money is, and that's what they see it as. It is definitely not a fair system. When you've got potentially 140 permits on our pond, and one person walks out and spends 3 hours on there once a year, the charge of $13,000 is astronomical. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I mean, I could see it if they had to come to each individual lot to do it, but they don't do that. They come out there and they look at one place on the pond. That's all they do. I don't know. We could have somebody in residence for $13,000 from the DNR, probably to stay there full time. I mean, we're paying somebody just about their full salary. So, I don't know. You have any questions?
Other questions for Mr. McGurdy? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Hirsch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological Resources Director, and I thought just what I would do is give a real brief background of how we've arrived, where we're at, and just provide a few comments on the bill. As Senator Rumbel mentioned, the 2008 legislature did direct the DNR to establish rules for aquatic plant management permit fees that recover the full cost of both administering and enforcing the aquatic plant permit program. And Senator Rumbel also mentioned, currently our existing permit revenues bring in about $300,000 a year, and our program costs are a little over $1 million. So we have to bring in a little bit more than three times the amount of current revenue that we're bringing in to comply with this directive. We are currently in a rulemaking process to raise the fees. In fact, we just had the public hearings in the last week in February. The fee that is the most affected, which is the one we've been talking about here, is the fee for control along an individual shoreline. Currently, that fee is $35, but the significant point here, I think, is this cap. There's currently a cap on group permits of $750. And so what happens is as the number of people exceeds 21, then the cost per person starts to go down the more and more people that are on the permit. And that's how you end up with situations like currently on Carey Pond where they're paying about, I think it was $7 a permit. Our proposal is to increase the permit fee for control along the individual property from $35 to $90 and eliminate the cap for group permits. So it does result in substantial increases when you look at it on a group permit basis. The other point I just wanted to bring up in terms of the legislative requirement is the legislature required us to report the fee rules to the legislature at least 45 legislative days before those rules are effective. So right now, we don't think we'll finish the rule during this legislative session, maybe towards the tail end, but what we're going to have to do is report it to the 2011 legislature and then wait for 45 legislative days. So the way the rule is worded now, it would go into effect on August 1st after those 45 legislative days. which would probably be August 1st, 2011, if things continue to progress. Just some specific comments about the bill before you. If the fees were reduced as described in the bill, as Senator Rummel said, it has a relatively small fiscal impact. We would have to raise other permits by about $3 per permit in order to cover the revenue loss from this bill. And I think there are some legitimate points here in terms of smaller ponds certainly do have some economies in terms of dealing with permits. The people are closer together, as been mentioned. But the size of the lake isn't the only cost driver. There are inspection requirements. There's a travel time from the office, the ability to group inspections between lakes. And then there's a number of very unpredictable cost drivers. We don't know where enforcement action is going to be taken. We don't know where we're going to do compliance monitoring. We don't know where aquatic plant permits might be appealed. And all those things are unpredictable and can result in more cost to the permit. So as Senator Rummel described, our approach was to try to keep it simple, a flat fee that reduces the complexity, ultimately reduces the number of errors we see in permit applications and keeps our administrative costs as low as possible. But I certainly understand the perception anyways that some people are paying more than they should under our proposal, or I should say will be paying more than they should because the rules aren't effective yet. That's about all I'd offer in terms of summary information. I can certainly answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. I'm looking at the fiscal note, and you talk about, okay, you think there'd be maybe 70 permits affected by this size of lakes, and then the bulk of them would be the over 9,000 permits that would be greater than 20 acres. That it would be spread around?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, and under the current permits, we show that's the $8,000 change, but then under the new ones, it would be a $28,000 difference.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And then we would anticipate by fiscal year 13, I think it is, that we would do new rules to cover that. Revenue shortfall, and then we'd no longer have any revenue shortfall.
Okay. Questions or discussion from the committee? All right. Well, we're kind of out of time. Oh, Senator Rummel, let's have you move the A1 amendment.
I don't have it in front of me.
It's up there right on the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A1 amendment, which makes some small changes to align this language with the current DNR language and creates an effective date of August 1st, 2010.
Okay, on the motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. If there's no other discussion, would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 2630? Senator Rummel moves that Senate File 2630 as amended be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rummel.
Thank you.
And members, the meeting is adjourned.
All right.